Okay, let us begin week 3 of Koheles. Thank you very much for being here and holding on. This is not an easy book. The first couple of weeks, just by way of recap, we started out by talking about Koheles as wisdom literature and comparing it, or more, contrasting it with the approaches found in Mishlei and in Iyov. And we moved from there into the authorship conversation. First of all, talking about it as one unified text with potentially a prologue and an epilogue, or an introduction and an epilogue. And the idea in Chazal that this is Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, as the author, even though the book does not say so explicitly, the challenge of why, if it is Shlomo, he calls himself Koheles instead of, as he does in the other books, Shlomo in Shir HaShirim and Mishlei, actually saying this is who he is, what's the meaning of the word Koheles, why we would say that Shlomo is the author. And then at the end, we talked about some of the arguments that are brought against it being Shlomo, and I concluded with the question of the fact that he says he made himself greater than all those who preceded him in Jerusalem, or on Jerusalem, and the problem, of course, being David is the only king before him in Yerushalayim, as far as Jews are concerned. There were kings in Jerusalem before us, you know, going back to Malki Tzedek, potentially, in the Torah, but really, would Shlomo have compared himself to them? We were also surprised that he would talk about himself as greater than his father. On the other hand, as we saw when we learned Malachim last year, there was some of that within Shlomo, saying that I'm building this temple that my father was not allowed to build, not using his father's assets. We talked about all of that. And at the end, there were questions from Susan and Moish that we didn't have time for because I had to run. So I wanted to start by asking, do you remember the questions I asked you last time to hold them? Were you able to hold them?
I don't, but I want to know why my Kohelet starts with something from Ibn Ezra.
I can't answer for your Kohelet. I can barely answer for mine. Okay, so it sounds, first of all, which edition are you using? Who's the publisher?
The Pequot.
Judaica Press. So it looks like they want you to read Ibn Ezra's introduction to the book, which we've quoted a little bit. So they're giving that to you before they give you the text itself. That's all. Moish, do you remember your question?
I actually was giving an answer to a question, and I offered the possibility that the reason Kohelet was not under an obvious name of Shlomo's is that thank you for your comment as well, was that having tried that in Shir HaShirim initially, he wanted to do something that did not have his name to see how people actually reacted, so that whether it was of wisdom or not, this way people could find out. That's just a possibility.
It's a fascinating idea. I'm not sure what you'll do with Chizkiyahu's role as the Gemara sees it, in bringing it to press, so to speak. In other words, it's not clear what Shlomo actually said to people versus what got published. But it's a fascinating idea, consistent with many fascinating ideas that I've gotten from you over the years. So thank you.
And you see, my holding on to that, that's why the Leafs won.
Oh, that's why. Thanks to you. It's you I can blame. The Leafs broke hockey. After that, nothing was the same. They should throw out everything that happens from now until June and start again in October. Okay. They also broke Koheles, because Koheles says generation comes, generation goes, and everything stays the same. It's not true anymore. So we are going to talk about, first of all, the content of the book in terms of giving it a little bit of an outline, using the outline by Professor Mordechai Zier Kavod in the Dat Mikra edition, which I gave you at the top of the source sheet. And then I want to move into the challenges of this book. We have already discussed some of them, or at least alluded to some of them. I want to focus on three challenges: the internal contradictions, the contradictions to traditional Jewish belief, and the appearance of simply being a human being reporting, you know, his experience. And these three are all challenges to canonization. Why in the world this would be in Tanakh? And then once we've got that, then I want to move into, so how have different groups, authors, dealt with those challenges? So starting out with the content of the book, you can see the outline on the sheet. So it begins with the introduction to the book, and really it's fairly clear that this is, if you have your Kohelet in front of you, it is very clear that this is an introduction to the book, presenting major ideas from the book. It starts out, the words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem, all is Hevel, which we still haven't translated. But that observation continues until the end of sentence 11, and then in sentence 12, it starts again. I am Kohelet. I was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So those opening sentences really do look like an introduction of sorts. By the way, just noticed it in my notes. I had forgotten. I wanted to dedicate learning today for Shmuel ben Itta Etel, Shmuel Kamenetsky, who you may know had a stroke. So we'll dedicate learning for Refuah Shlema for him. I also have another chola in mind, but because it's somebody local, I don't want to say the name in case they don't want that. Okay, but that's the opening part. That's the opening 11 sentences. Then after that, you get the experimentation that Kohelet engaged in that convinced him that everything is Hevel. I'm just going to translate Hevel right now as evanescent, temporary, futile, not lasting, not enduring, even though there's more to be said that I hope to eventually say about the word. But he describes, starting in sentence 13, you know, I examined wisdom, I saw all the deeds that are performed, I increased more wisdom than any before me in Jerusalem. And a lot about the wisdom that he pursued. But then over into chapter 2, he talks about wine, he talks about building, he talks about gardens and orchards and vineyards and whatnot. He talks about his property, his gold, his silver. I did it all. And that led me to this conclusion that everything is Hevel. That's the second phase of the book. Then you get chapter 3, and chapter 3 is the one with the famous poem in the beginning, to everything there is a time, right? That's there in the beginning, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot, dot, 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 dot. And this is the passage in which he talks about the human being's place in the world and the human being's place in the relationship with God. That's here as well. So if you're looking for the God part, that's the latter part of this chapter. And then chapter 4 begins with a complaint about the corruption of human society. So you start out at the beginning of chapter 4. If you look at sentence 1, I see all of the corruption, the way people are harmed under the sun. I see how people are crying and there's no one to comfort them. And he then talks about the dead, and he says, yeah, they're in better shape, as opposed to people who have not yet lived. And he goes on to talk about the amal he has seen, and we're going to have to translate amal at some point. Sometimes it means struggle, sometimes it means wickedness. How do you know which one is which? He talks about people who attack each other. You can see it for yourself as you go through the chapter until you get to sentence 17. And in sentence 17, he again seems to have a change of tone. Don't be bothered, we've said this before in other contexts, don't be bothered by the fact that there is a change of pace, a change of tone, and it's not at the chapter break. We are not responsible for the chapter breaks any more than I am responsible for Judaica Press's decision to put Ibn Ezra's introduction before the book of Kohelet. The chapter breaks, for some reason, break after sentence 17. But it does seem fairly clear that sentence 17 is a new thought, as he turns to somebody who is planning to go to the house of God, and he says to him, "Watch your feet when you go." And he continues there in the beginning of chapter 5 by talking about how you speak before God. So this is advice for the pilgrim who is going to the Beis HaMikdash, who's going to the temple. You may recall when we talked about who wrote the book, I said that those who approach it from a non-Solomon perspective still agree with the idea that it's written by somebody in Jerusalem, and the fact that you have this emphasis on the temple and the sacrifices, which shows up not only in this part, but certainly in this part, supports that idea. So you get, running up until sentence 7, is the passage about the one who is going to speak to God and going to the temple. And then you get chapter 5, sentence 8. And that is, according to Professor Zer Kavod, a section on criticizing the pursuit of wealth. So starting from chapter 5, sentence 8, and then going all the way till chapter 6, sentence 9. Criticizing the pursuit of wealth, starting with one of the more famous passages in Kohelet, Ohev kesef lo yizba kesef, right? Somebody who loves money will not have his full of money. That's a sentence that would have been very comfortable in Mishlei, right? We talked about the similar structures and sometimes even content. So that sentence certainly would have been very comfortable there. He talks about the person who works hard. He talks about the wealth of the wealthy, and maybe it's not always so good for him. And that takes us to the next section within the book, which is the random section. Chapter 6, sentence 10. Talk about something that would feel very comfortable in Mishlei. A random section. Chapter 6, sentence 10. Running through chapter 7, sentence 14. Smart things to say is basically what we're talking about here. So it begins with, chapter 6, sentence 10. Yeah. Masha haya kvar nikra shemo v'noda asher hu adam. I don't even know what that means. Someone give me a translation from your editions.
Which verse exactly?
Chapter 6, sentence 10.
Okay.
Gita.
I have. Okay.
I'll take any, but Gita raised her hand and said she's ready. So Gita, unmute yourself and tell me what you have. And welcome back from Israel.
Thank you. What I have is a 10.
Yes.
Yes. I just had it. I'm sorry. Whosoever cometh into being, the name thereof was given long ago, and it is foreknown what man is. Neither can he contend with him that is meant mightier than he, seeing there are many words and increased vanity. What is man the better?
Okay. What edition is that you're using?
Sansino, which I always use.
And they call that a translation?
I mean,
it's written in English words, but they don't seem to make sentences.
It's incomprehensible. I have entirely different.
Okay, go. Esther, what do you have? And then Susan. Okay, go ahead. What does he have?
What was has already been called by name and is known, as he is man and cannot deal with one more powerful than he.
Okay. I think if I read that slower and I had it in front of me, I might grasp that. Susan, what does the pink book have?
Mine's very similar. What was, its name was already called. And it is known that he is a man, and he will not be able to strive with him who is stronger than he.
Nope. Sorry. Not working for me. But
I have the Jerusalem Bible.
Okay, Jerusalem Bible.
That which has been was named a long, long, long ago, and it is known as that is but a man, nor may become content with one who is mightier than he.
Okay, maybe it's just me, but I'm not succeeding. I mean, this sentence has bothered me for many, many years. Moshe, thank you for your notes in the chat on who would have done these different translations. I actually just noticed we've given four translations. No one's had an art scroll. Anybody here using an art scroll? Ah, Florence, can you tell me what does the art scroll say for this sentence?
Unmute yourself.
Yeah, she will.
Florence is muted.
Yeah, no, she'll unmute.
It's Santino, not
Armstrong. Oh, no, well, Santino was the one we've already had the pleasure of.
No, I have Santino.
Okay, so maybe Art Scroll's translation is clearer.
That one is Santino.
Okay. Okay, wait, Leah has Art Scroll. Leah, are you able to read out what you have, or your speaker doesn't work? I remember that you had an issue with your speaker. Yeah, speaker doesn't work. Oh, well, we have an Art Scroll, but it's mute. So we're going to do without, and that's okay. The bottom line is that this is supposed to be beginning a section of wise sayings, and once I don't understand it, I can assume it's wise. Some of the other sentences that are in here are a lot easier, like chapter 7, sentence 1, another Mishle-style sentence, right? Tov shem mishem en tov, right? Better to have a reputation than to have good oil. Yom Hamavetz Miyom Hivalado, that's a little bitter. The day of death is better than the day one is born. Better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a party, because that's the end of a person, and the living will take that to heart. Better to have anger than to have laughter. This is somebody who's not necessarily in a great mood, but on the other hand, he's found a justification for being in a bad mood. Bad moods are better for you than good moods. So that's where he's going with this in this section, and in general, it's an anthology of wise sayings. Moshe, you said you have an art scroll option for us.
Yeah, this is 610?
Yes.
So what has been was already named, and it is known that he is but a man. He cannot contend with one who is mightier than he.
Okay, thank you. And Leah, thank you for writing it in. It's okay.
It's totally different.
Oh, totally different. All right, fine. Let's hear the totally different one.
Do not say what went wrong. That times gone by were better than...
Oh, no, you're on... That's chapter 7, sentence 10.
Oh, the one... Okay.
What you're reading is chapter 7, sentence 10.
So what it says here?
I believe you, but it is.
Okay.
Let's yeah. Come back to 610 in this series. So we've now had the opportunity to benefit from six different translations, and we're going to go further. If you jump to the end of this section in Zer Kavod's outline, chapter 7, sentence 15 starts the next section, in which he speaks to the imperfection of human beings. He says, there are righteous people who are lost in their righteousness. There are wicked people who go on their merry way doing bad things. Don't be too righteous. Don't be too wise. Why should you be ruined? We will probably come back to that sentence. Don't do a lot of bad things. Don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? The most famous line in this section will be chapter 7, sentence 20, in which he says, there is nobody who is righteous and only does good things and never does bad. Which you can read in a lot of different ways, and we're going to be coming back to that sentence. That certainly would be my plan. This section goes all the way through chapter 8, sentence 17. He has a lot to say about the fallibility of people and about God's responses to human behavior. He's got a lot that about that here as well. Not everything in it is positive. If you take a look at chapter 8, sentence 14, for example, he says, there are righteous people who receive like the deeds of the wicked. And then there are wicked people who receive like the deeds of the righteous. Go figure. Not a sentence you would see in Mishlei, right? Other than that one that we saw about Yesh Nisper Belo Mishpat. But that's his challenge here. And then he gives us a new section. Chapter 9, sentence 1.
My book translates Hevel as vanity.
Yeah, we're going to translate that. We're going to translate Hevel at some point. Don't get caught up in the translations for it. It's not worth it. It's Hevel. So he says in chapter 9, Ricky, I see your hand. Can it wait till the end of the outline? Thanks. So chapter 9, we get a new section, which is the entire chapter, talking about, as I wrote on the sheet, humans are in God's hands, so just be happy with whatever God gives you. And that's literal, right? Chapter 9, sentence 1, look at it. He says, the tzaddikim, the chachamim, the sages, their servants, biyad ha'elokim, they're in God's hand. He goes on to say, the same fate befalls the tzaddik, the wicked person, the good, the pure, the impure, the one who brings a sacrifice, the one who doesn't bring a sacrifice, the good one, the sinner, the one who swears, the one who is afraid to swear. Everyone is meeting the same fate anyway, and we're going to have to talk about that idea for sure. Sentence 7, he says, go eat your bread in joy, drink your wine with a good heart. God has already desired your actions. He's accepted you. He's talking a lot in this section about how you should just accept whatever it is that God sends your way. Chapter 10 is also its own theme, a collection of sayings about what it's good to do and what it's bad to do. So you'll see, he talks about wisdom, he talks about foolishness, basically a lot about wisdom and foolishness in the early part of the chapter, as well as flipping through it, the later part of the chapter as well. And then in chapter 11, he starts out by talking to the farmer. Investment advice. Chapter 11, sentence 1. Cast your bread on the face of the water, for over time, you will find it. Isn't that what they said at First Republic Bank? I don't know. Okay. I don't know. And then he continues to say, the clouds and the rain. This is a set of agricultural images. Talks about planting, one of the classic lines in chapter 11, sentence 6. In the morning, you should sow your seeds. And don't stop in the evening either. You don't know which one is going to work out. The next section starts right there in sentence 7. Even though it starts with and, which my teacher in second grade said you're not allowed to do. Nonetheless, it's a brand new thought, a brand new section, and it starts with and. Chapter 11, sentence 6. And the light is sweet. Those of you who knew Rabbi Saltzman, from Adath Israel, so is his mother, was my second grade teacher. Anyway, chapter 11, sentence 7, begins by talking about how light is sweet and it's good to see the sun. And then, of course, because this is Kohelet, he's going to get depressing. So he says, if a person lives a long time, he should rejoice. He should be happy in all of his years. And he should remember the days of darkness, because that's coming too. Be happy when you are young. Your heart will be good for you in the days of your youth. All of this advice, the joy of youth, as I called it on the sheet. And that switches into the weakness of age. And you get in chapter 12 a metaphor for the deterioration of the body. This is one of the classic sections in Koheles, where he describes parts of the body that are deteriorating in a barely veiled metaphor. So, for example, in chapter 12, sentence 3, he talks about the tochanot, the grinders, becoming few, and the windows going dark. So he obviously means the teeth and the eyes. Like, this is not very hard to analyze and figure out. Until you get to the end of that section in sentence 7, where he talks about the return to dust. And then you get a wrap-up, a summary, the end of chapter 12, which Gordas thought was an epilogue after the book, because when you read it, you see that it's a description of what Kohelet said and did. It sounds like it's an outside speaker describing what he said and did. So that's your basic outline of what's here in the book. And you can already see the seeds of the controversies that we're now going to talk about, right? The ideas which would not find their home in much of Torah. The ideas that seem to contradict each other. The expressions which seem to just be a human being talking and not something where it's God weighing in. So that's where we have to go next. But Ricky, you waited. Thank you very much. What were you going to say? Nope. We're good? Okay. Other questions or comments about the outline that Professor Zera Kavod provided. By the way, just like when we read Shir HaShirim, and just like when we read Mishlei, and I tried to outline it, I noted it for those books, you could argue with this outline. You could find other ways to break it up. You could challenge and say that certain things that he calls a unit should really be subdivided. That's fine. On the other hand, having an outline like this, I find to be helpful for me as I try to grasp the text. And then you can personalize it as you choose. Yes, Moshe.
I was just going to say that according to the Gordas logic, where when the voice changes from first person to the third person, so that same logic where he gets an epilogue from the last couple of lines, surely would also get him a prologue from the first, what, 8 lines or so.
Yeah, no, he's very much a believer in the idea that there's the prologue in the beginning. The question would be what he does in chapter 7 when it also has Amra Koheles. Right? What would he do with that? So, like I said, we have 3 different types of challenges described in the book. And the first one we'll talk about are the internal contradictions. Why are internal contradictions a challenge for inclusion in Tanakh? Why should that be an issue? Why would, if you were a canonizer of Tanakh, why would you not want to include texts that contradict themselves? Yeah, Susan.
But you think this is from Solomon, and it's supposed to be a holy book, it's in the Tanakh. You're saying one thing with one hand and another thing with the other. How can it be consistent? How can you say it's right? Nobody.
Right. So I don't know if this is what you're saying, but what I'm hearing is, how can, if God inspires somebody, if there's divinely imparted wisdom here, why does it contradict itself? Why can't, you know, why does it sound like all those translations of chapter 6, sentence 10? That's really not about contradictions. That's just about weird language. But that's one problem. I'll go further and say including it in Tanakh makes Tanakh look bad. That's where you're going. Okay. And also, imagine the poor person who says, I need some insight and inspiration today. I'm going to open my Tanakh. And he opens it, and he can't figure out what it's telling him to do. What exactly is this? What am I supposed to get out of this? Now, I don't know. There are people who like Zen koans that they have to sit there and meditate on for a very long time before they come to some kind of inspiration. So maybe that's okay. But it's certainly not the general style that we use in Tanakh. And Chazal, our sages, noticed this. Take a look, please, at source number 1. Gemara in Shabbos, which gives us 2 examples of internal contradictions. Bikshu chachamim lignoz sefer Koheles. The sages wanted to put away Koheles. Mipnei shedvarav sosrin ze'edze. Because its words contradict each other. Umipnei malo ganzuhu. So why didn't they put it away? Mipnei shetchilaso divrei Torah v'sofo divrei Torah. Because it begins with Torah and ends with Torah. We're going to come back to that idea. I'm not sure this week or next week. But we have to talk about that. Umay devarav sosrin zedze. What do you mean when you say its words contradict each other? Well, ksiv, it is written, tov kaz misachok. Anger is better than laughter. I'm translating schok as laughter. You could argue with that, but that's my translation. Uchsiv l'schok amarti meholal. But on the other hand, it says, of laughter I saw, I said it should be, that's a typo. Of laughter I said it is to be praised. Taking meholal, the word meholal admits of multiple translations, but one translation would be like the word halel. It is to be praised. So I don't understand. Anger is better than laughter. Laughter should be praised. Another one. Ksiv, it says, v'shibachti ani es hasimcha. I praised joy. Uchsiv, and it also says, ulesimcha mazo osa. Joy, what does that do? Is happiness good or is happiness useless? So you could resolve these contradictions, and in fact, the sages do address them. But things like that, the Talmud points to and says, why do I need to include that in Tanakh? The sages said, we don't need that there. Professor Zer Kavod gives more examples of this. If you take a look at source number 2, I gave you some references. He points you to chapter 1, sentence 2. Chapter 1, sentence 2 says, Habel Havalim, Amar Koheles, which I'm going to translate at, well, here's the end of the line. Havel Havalim, Hakol Havel. Everything is Havel, and whatever your translation of Havel, whether you take useless, whether you take temporary, whether you take a breath as a translation of Havel, it means something that is passing, something that is not enduring. But then on the other hand, in chapter 1, sentence 4, he says, V'ha'arex le'olam amades. The earth remains forever. Which is it? Is it here and gone, or is it enduring? That's an example that Professor Zer Kavod identifies. Another example that he identifies. Take a look at chapter 3, sentence 21. Mi yodea, he says. Who knows? Ruach b'nei ha'adam, the spirit of human beings. Ha'olahi lamala, does it go up to the heavens? Ruach ha'behema ha'yoredes hilamata la'aretz, the spirit of the animal, does it go down to the earth? And then on the other hand, in chapter 12, sentence 7, he has a very clear answer for where it goes. He says, v'yashov ha'afar al ha'aretz kishahaya, when a person dies, if a person dies, then the dirt returns to the ground as it was, and the spirit goes to God who gave it. So in chapter 3, he didn't have an answer. In chapter 12, he does have an answer. Lest you say, well, by the time he gets to chapter 12, he knows more than he did in the beginning, and he has answers. That's not the way this book works. You will find things that he's sure about earlier on and not sure about later on as well. One other example of contradictions that Professor Zer Kavod points out. Go back to chapter 1, sentence 18. The last sentence in chapter 1, where he says, you want to know what makes people angry? It's being too smart. He says, Ki berov chochma, rov kaas. With great wisdom comes great anger. Right? With great power comes great responsibility. With great wisdom comes great anger, he says. And then on the other hand, in chapter 7, sentence 9, he says at the end of the sentence, Ki kaas b'cheik ksilim yonuach, because anger rests in the bosom of fools. I thought wise people were the one who got angry. Now apparently fools are the ones who get angry. I don't know. So what's with all of the, you know, all of the contradictions here? Now, the truth is many of his contradictions that he brings, he has a long list, are easily resolved. If anybody uses a Dan Mikra edition, it's in his introduction, like page 24 to 26 or so. He lists a whole bunch of them. So many of them are easily resolved. But he's definitely right that the book could be a lot clearer, number one, and number two, a lot shorter. If you stop contradicting yourself and you just pick a side, you know, you don't need 12 chapters. So that's one type of problem in this book. Thoughts on the contradictions or questions? I'm not looking for ways to resolve them yet. We're going to talk about that. But just on the issue of contradictions in the book. Yeah, Joyce. Yeah.
You just translate that as temporary.
So we're going to spend time on the definition of Hevel. I'm just not there yet.
What does that have to do with vanity?
So it's a different use of the word vanity than the way people use vanity in our day.
Uh-huh.
It's not vanity meaning like ego. It's a different use of the word vanity. It means something that has no purpose. It's in vain. You know, we are taking God's name in vain. That type of use of the word vanity. That's what they're referring to. Yes, Moshe.
Yeah, just in terms of commenting on the coherence issue.
Yes.
Yeah. On a personal level, I guess my comment would be that, you know, I've read all the books of the Bible, and I can give a fair summary of basically all of them, mm-hmm. except for Kohelet. Kohelet mm-hmm. is the one book I can't, the only summary that I think is, that it does some justice to the contents is, well, in the beginning he talks about Hevel, the end he talks about Hevel, in the middle he talks a lot about Hevel. So Hevel is sort of a leitmotif, which I can say accurately reflects a big theme of the book. He says the same line in the beginning and the end, Hevel Avolim, Hevel Avolim. So that suggests to me that he's trying an inclusio or something like that. So I can say that's the theme, whatever Hevel is. But beyond that, I can't really... I have trouble
yes.
pinning him down.
No, he doesn't want to be summarized. He really doesn't. He's not a creature of the modern age. Esther.
I think building on that, I've often found comfort in the contradictions because not everything in life is clear cut, and sometimes you're looking for affirmation of that. And so not only is his content not clear cut, but his whole style. His whole style is not clear cut, and you can find anything you want in it. In a sense, you can read what you want to read into it, or you just pull the right verses out of context, or whatever you want to do. And there's something kind of comforting about that.
So we're going to talk about that. Not this week, probably not next week either. Maybe you make it into next week. But when we talk about how we've attempted over time to deal with the problems of the book. Embracing the bug as a feature is a central approach to Kohelet, certainly in modern times. So we're going to come back to that idea. I did see a couple of other hands, but now I'm forgetting where. Susan, Ricky? No, Ricky?
I'm not on a level of the previous speakers, but how can write something? It's like saying, everything is a lie, and so is this book. Everything is Hevel, and so is everything I say in this book. How does it...
No, that line is in here also. He has a line in the book in which he says that, you know, people make all these books. There's no end to books. He's not a fan of people who go on at length in their books and publish a lot either. He's honest.
Yes, so why write something that is worthless? That is Hevel.
Well, this is where we're going. This is where we're going. Right now we're dealing with the problems, and then we're going to get to eventually the approaches. So let's talk about the second type of problem. And that is the contradictions to the traditional Jewish belief. And, you know, obviously this is a concern because promoting it could undermine people's faith. And it also, again, undermines the sense that this book is divinely inspired and worthy of being in Tanakh. Examples are many. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 3. This was flagged for me by somebody in an email when I sent out the source sheet. Very often when I'm teaching something in Tanakh, it's something that I also taught you know, 20, 25 years ago. I've reached that stage where I've got something that I taught back then. And so I look back at my previous source sheet and I'll cut and paste a source to put on the new one, but I've changed in my style for the source that we're talking about. So if you take a look at number three, this comes from a class that I taught, I think, when I was in Rhode Island, which would have been 1997 to 2001. And I translate there, if you look at the opening line, the sages wanted to ban Ecclesiastes, the Hebrew is lignos. If you take a look at source number one, Bikshu Chachamim Lignos, right? The sages wanted Lignos. There I translated it as put away rather than ban. I'm inclined to write put away, and that's number one is the translation that I did last week. But I pulled the translation in number three from the old one, which I didn't bother to check that. That's why it says ban. But don't worry about it. So Amrabi Binyamin ben Bar-Levi, or Binyamin Bar-Levi said, Bikshu lignos sefer Koheles. The sages wanted to ban Ecclesiastes. Shematz, or put away, Shematzu bo dvarim shem notin litzad minus. Because they found in it that which is inclined towards heresy. Amru, they said, Kach haya ra'ui Shlomo lomar. Should Shlomo really have said this? Smach b'chur b'yadusecha, b'tiv chalib chalimei b'churosecha. O youth, rejoice in your youth. Your heart will be good for you in the days of your youth. Is that right for him to say that? Didn't Moshe say, don't stray after your hearts and your eyes. You're not supposed to be pursuing pleasure, which is what they assume youth is all about. I should note that when we talk about something as minus here, min is very often rendered as something that challenges or attacks Torah. So heresy is a good loose translation sort of for it. There's nothing heretical about saying enjoy your youth. It's just not Jewish philosophy, you know, religious philosophy of life normally. But the point here is it's contradicting what the Chumash says. It's contradicting what Moshe says. Another example that this Medrash brings, Shlomo said, V'halach v'darchei libcha u'mar e'enecha, follow the paths of your heart, follow what you see with your eyes, you should just go after what you want. Didn't Moshe say, don't stray after your heart and your eyes, the passage that we just quoted. You could almost read it actually as the first verse is just upsetting in its own right. Youth. Be happy with your youth. Your heart will be good to you in the days of your youth. That's one problem in and of itself, because we know that the Torah doesn't like that. I have another problem. Moshe said, don't follow your hearts and eyes. Koheles says, you should follow your hearts and your eyes. Elo hutra ritsua les din v'les dayan. There's no justice. There's no judge. That's what it sounds like. Just go have fun. The strap of the enforcer in the court is meaningless. So there's a way to resolve this as the text continues and as we're going to come back to. But the point is, they look at this and say, this isn't what Judaism normally teaches. Now, it's very interesting to me. If you were yourself looking at this passage, where you see that Koheles says you should follow your hearts and eyes, would you be really horrified to find that in Tanakh? Is that like, oh my, how does that ever make it into Tanakh? Does that rise to the level of like, this doesn't belong here?
No.
No, it really doesn't, right, Kita?
Yes, because it can also be the Tovah. It also can be aware of what's going on, what's right, what's wrong, who's in front of you, who's behind you.
You could definitely find justifications for it, but even if it is what it sounds like, take a look at source number four, please. I went looking for more obvious religious problems, and I didn't have to look very hard. Take a look at chapter 2, sentence 24. Ein tov ba'adam sheyochal v'shasa v'heroes nafsho tov ba'amalo. He says, there's nothing better for a person than to eat, to drink, and to feel good. Like, that's much more clear as an embrace of personal pleasure, physical pleasure. Take a look at chapter 5. Chapter 5, sentence 17. All these verses are there in source number 4 on your sheet. I think it's good to eat, to drink, and to see good things in all of your struggle under the sun. You should enjoy yourself. Chapter 8, sentence 16. 8:16 is not what I wanted. No, 8:15 is what I wanted. Sorry, typo.
8:15.
15, not 16. There is nothing good for the person under the sun but to eat, drink, and be merry. And one more for good measure, chapter 11, sentence 9. Actually, this is the one. This is what they quoted there in the passage in the Medrash in source number 3. You've got many verses that are very strong about pursuing physical pleasure. But not just that. Take a look at chapter 7, sentence 15. He talks about how he has seen it all in his life of Havel. There are righteous people who are lost or destroyed in their righteousness. There are wicked people who go on in their wickedness. Chapter 8, sentence 14. There are righteous people who receive like the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people who receive like the deeds of the righteous. Right? The wicked thrive, the righteous suffer. If you wanted to say this book contradicts traditional Jewish belief, that's what you should have picked. Not encouragement to enjoy your youth or to follow your eyes. But it gets better or worse, depending on your perspective. Take a look at chapter 3, sentence 19. We're still in source number 4 on the sheet. You see that? The fate of the human being and the fate of the beast, they all have the same fate. As one dies, so the other dies. One spirit for all. There is nothing greater for the human being than the beast. It is all Hevel. Right? And he's not done. Keep reading. All goes to one place. Everything comes from the dirt. It's gone back to the dirt. Who knows whether the spirit of a human being goes up to the heavens, the spirit of the animal goes down to the ground, right? That sounds an awful lot like he doesn't believe in the afterlife, no? Chapter 9, sentences 5 and 6. He says, The living know that they're gonna die. The dead don't know anything. They have no reward. Their memory is forgotten. Their love, their hate, their jealousy, it's all gone. And they have nothing else in all that is done under the sun. You could explain it away a little bit, but the bottom line is that this is not, this is not an endorsement of afterlife belief for sure. This is difficult. So my question to you is not how do you deal with these being in Tanakh. My question is, when the sages are pointing out in source number 3 that there are things in Koheleth that are inclined towards heresy, why didn't they bring like things like that that are much more hardcore towards heresy, like, yeah, I don't know if there's anything happening for human beings as opposed to animals after death. Why didn't you bring that as an example of heresy? Why did you bring encouragement to follow your heart? What would you say? I can only offer two directly opposite suggestions. One suggestion that I could offer is that it's because they didn't want to raise the most challenging things. like, let's not show everybody the real problems. Let's just, you know, if we can just shun this and just put it away. That's one possibility. Opposite, they consider these things obvious to resolve. These things that are so egregious are so obviously not what they mean. As opposed to the other. This wasn't the real problem. Whichever approach you're gonna take, I did want to add, I did want
to- They're egregious, do you mean that he's being sarcastic? That he's not saying it, that he's saying it tongue in cheek?
No, when I use egregious, I mean it to say these are really bad. And I'm saying that maybe they didn't-
So they can't be resolved.
Sorry?
So they cannot be resolved.
That's one way to look at it. I mean, the other answer is that they had. They believed that you shouldn't read these this way. They believed that there's a different idea, which we're going to see. We're going to come to, not this week, but next, I hope, how they resolved sentences like this, because they did approach them.
Is that how they did, like, shirashirim, where they made the sentences allegories?
No, because shirashirim is a wholesale rewrite of the book. It's to say this is all metaphor. You can't do, there's no metaphor here. This is just,
no.
Here it is. Okay. I wanted to note two things that I thought were very interesting. One of them I have no idea what to do with, but the other one I think is, well, let me start with the one that I do know what to do with. Rav Menachem Meiri, 13th century, if I remember correctly. Actually, I wrote it on the sheet. 13th century Provence. Excellent. So he writes something very interesting about Koheles and Iov. If you're worried about Koheles being heretical, what about Iov, who's yelling at God all the time? Why didn't that concern them? Look what he says. It's going to support some of the things that we learned when we did Iov. He says in number 5, Ve'im ula yis'o'er ha'sho'el. The questioner might be awakened lomar to say, Kalach l'derech zu, go this route. Lama lo bikshu ligno sefer Iov. Why didn't they try to put away the book of Iov? Sharei bevada yeshbo dvarim notim ledivrei minus. It certainly includes things that are inclined towards heresy. Uperishu ktsas mefarshim bazeh. She Iov lo nisbarer heyosom yibalei hados. So some have explained. This is always the Meiri's approach. Meiri doesn't name his sources. He gives them all descriptions. He talks about the Rambam and he says, Gedolei HaMechabrim. He does that. So I don't know who he's talking about, but he says, some have explained that Iov, it's not so clear that he's a person of religion, by which he means Judaism, in the book. We don't know that Iov is Jewish. Ve'ein chashash lavot hakala al yado. So there's no concern that it's going to lead to a problem, because we'll just say, okay, he's not representing Judaism. Ah, he's in Tanakh. Okay, but he's not Jewish. Mitzoraf lezeh, and this is the great line. In addition to this, Shalohai amafursam b'chachma. Iov is not known to be very bright. How do you like that? His poetry is better than mine. But he's not known to be very bright. K'moshin odami tarav. Look at the descriptions of Iov in the book. Shenamar, when Iov gets that great description in the book, it says, Tam v'yashar yirei Elokim v'sar meira. He is without defect. He is righteous. He is God-fearing. He stays away from evil. V'lo ne'emar chacham. It doesn't say that he's smart. That's not there. Amnam, Shlomo hayame anshe hadas. But Shlomo is certainly a man of the religion. V'noda v'chochmos v'yiru mikashol b'nei adam b'divarav. He was known for being smart. So if he says, I don't know what happens to the soul when a person dies, that's a much more serious thing than if Iov does. I thought that was fascinating, this idea. Well, I hate to tell you this, Moshe, I see your note in the chat, but he also did the same thing to Koheles. But if you take a look at source number 6, this is just something I thought was interesting. I didn't have anything to really do, to do with it. The Medrash that we brought in source number, the Medrash that we brought in number 3 talks about the fear of contradicting Moshe. How could you say X when Moshe said Y? So there's one other passage that I'm familiar with in Medrash. It's in the Gemara in Yevamos, where you find the same allegation. Menashe, is credited with killing Yeshaya. You may recall, as the Gemara in Brachos says, Yeshaya's daughter marries Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu's son is Menashe. So Menashe is Yeshaya's grandson. So Menashe is credited with killing Yeshaya. We discussed this when we learned Yeshaya. I'm not going into the whole thing in depth now. But Rava says that he judged Yeshaya. Amar, he said to Yeshaya, Moshe Rabcha Amar Kilo Yerani Ha'adam V'chai. Your master Moshe said that God said, no one can see me and live. V'yad Amrit, but you described God's throne room. You said, Bo'eres Hashem Yosheva Kisei Ram V'nisa. You said, I saw God sitting on a great and elevated throne. You're contradicting Moshe. I have nothing to do in particular with it. I just find it interesting that it's the same contention of, hey, you're contradicting Moshe, shows up in this other place as, you know, the one that we saw. But in any case, that's the second challenge, is the apparent heretical ideas. The third challenge is, it just seems like it's basic human wisdom. Why is it in Tanakh? And we have already seen that challenge. If you take a look at source number 7, we've seen this before, but I brought it again on the sheet, the discussion about whether Koheles is metame es hayadayim, whether it renders hands tame. We explained last week that only books that are considered sacred, such that someone would keep truma with them, are subject to the rabbinic decree that they make one's hands tame, such that you don't want to keep your truma with them. They wanted to discourage that. So Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya says, Koheles eno metame es hayadayim. Koheles does not render hands tame. Why? Because it was just Shlomo's wisdom. It was Shlomo talking. This is the Gemara in Megillah coming from the Tosefta. Medrashin Avos Rabbi Nasan actually says this was a concern for all three books of Shlomo. I wanted to note that in source number 8. You see it alleged for Mishle, Shir Hashirim, and Koheles that these are all Mishalot, they're lessons. They don't belong in scripture. That's another one that's an old source of mine. I should have said lessons, not parables. But there's a lot in the book, in Koheles, that suggests that it's really not divine. It doesn't claim divine authorship. At no point does it say, and God said to me. There's also frequent use of the first person. Right? I this, I that. I saw these things. This is what I say. If you want to see references, just take a fast look at chapter 1, sentence 16. Right? Dibarti ani imli bi. I spoke of my heart saying, ani, I, higdaldi vehosafti. If you take a look at chapter 2, the entire chapter. Amarti ani bili bi. I said in my heart. And you just keep on going through the chapter where he describes, this is what I did, this is what I said. Sorry, Susan, I'm in the last 2 minutes. Add to that the apparent internal contradictions we've already noted, right? It really sounds like it's just me talking. Now, this problem does not endure. The other two problems are more serious problems. This one, the sages basically outvoted the view that said this is human wisdom. So if you take a look at source number 9, I brought you all the different views about whether Kohelet in fact renders hands tamei, and the conclusion in the discussion is that it does. They decided that it is not human wisdom, it is in fact sanctified. That's their conclusion. But how did they deal with the problems? How did they deal with these issues? So that's what I want to. You know, they basically discount the idea that it's human written. How do they deal with these other problems that we have? That's what I want to start with, God willing, next time. Susan, you have a minute. Do you have a question?
Is this why we consider than the other books, because it's not, it has questions to it.
What do you mean by less holy?
Well, I would think that Torah is the most holy, that
Right, so Koheles is in Ksuvim. It's in the section of Tanakh called the Writings, which are understood not to be prophecy, but rather divine inspiration. That's the classic division. But that's, it's in good company. It's there with Tehillim.
No, I know, but I'm saying that we look at it differently than we look at the Midrash.
Yeah, but that's not a function necessarily of these issues. That's more a function of its authorship and what it claims to be. It doesn't claim to be prophecy. Gita.
I need to know if there's a class next week. A lot fuller.
Yes, God willing, there will be a class next week. Everyone can get their haircuts before or after. 1:30 to 2:30 is off limits. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Be well.